This is the fourth day of this April 2017 seven-day session. Back to the talks by the 14th century Japanese Zen master Basui from a book called Mud and Water, translated by Arthur Braverman. We'll pick up where we left off yesterday, where he was answering a questioner. I won't go back and reread the question. It doesn't really matter. But he was talking about, Basui was talking about the conscious mind, and tried to relate this to a more commonly used word like the discriminating mind, the delusive mind. Let's pick up here. The conscious mind is the boss of notorious robbers, the origin of the 10 evil deeds, and the pit of knowledge based on attachment to form. The boss of notorious robbers, as in having our clear wisdom and eye of enlightenment stolen from us, not in any fundamental way, but as long as we're dwelling in this discriminating mind. The origin of the 10 evil deeds and the pit of knowledge based on attachment to form. Again, I think I was saying this yesterday, this phrase he uses, attachment to form. Just think of attachment to appearances, the world of appearances, of phenomena. Believing that that's all there is to this world is what we see. What we see and hear and taste and smell and touch and think about. Attachment to form really means attachment to differences. Yes, there are differences. Everywhere, in everything, there are differences. This is the world of differentiation, of form, of appearances. But that's just half of reality. If it is not destroyed, this conscious mind, though you were to speak wonderful words of the miraculous, they would all be no more than strange spirits of wild foxes. In the end, you wouldn't be able to avoid floating in the world of transmigration. It is caught in the ceaseless round of existences, existences of delusion and pain. That's why its destruction is connected with the one great matter. Again, as we said yesterday, the destruction, the so-called destruction of the conscious mind, means seeing beyond this little mind the little mind that divides, that sets other against self. The reason for transmigration through the six realms of existence, from the beginningless beginning to the present, tossing and turning in great pain, is that you can't turn off this conscious mind. Well, we get a good close-up look at that in Sesshin, when despite our many efforts, we find that this mind keeps running and running and running and sucking us in to its machinations, its deceits. again, to be very precise here, it's not that we need to turn it off, this discursive mind and its thinking. It's just that we have to avoid getting drawn into it and lingering in it. We can see it in its workings, this discriminating mind, without getting snared by it. That's what we learn. That's a skill that we learn through Zazen, and especially in Sesshin, is to refrain from getting dragged into it. We see it at work, we see this thinking mind repeatedly asserting itself, but we have a choice. We have another option, and that is to go to the practice that we're working on, which is for just that purpose, to free us from the tyranny of this discriminating mind. The tree of swords and the mountain of blades are born of it. The boiling kiln and burning coal come from it also. These are allusions to some of the popular ideas of hells, Buddhist hells, of pain and suffering. The demons and devils, too, come from nowhere else. The beast with hair and horns is no other than a product of this conscious mind. Though there are new heads and different faces, some dying here and being reborn there, though there may be retribution from various results of causes, some becoming beautiful and some becoming ugly, all are a result of nothing other than this conscious mind. Well, we just recited in the Hakuin chant, the cause of our sorrow is ego delusion. Dark path to dark path, we've wandered in darkness. That's the darkness of this discriminating mind. How can we be free from the wheel of samsara? And then in answer, Hakuin says, the gateway to freedom is Zazen Samadhi. Absolute oneness with the practice we're working on. That is our deliverance. Most people know only this discriminating mind. There's nothing else that they've ever experienced practically. Maybe some moments here and there as a kind of a grace, something that comes over them, and lovemaking or music or some other activity that frees them momentarily from this chattering mind. But to have a method to train ourselves to live there more and more, this realm that is beyond the discriminating mind. It's great. Great opportunity. He goes on, though it is said never to have form, that is the mind, it is like fire which kindles flame in firewood when the proper contact is made. If this contact no longer exists, quiet sets in. When it moves, it is like clouds and mist appearing. When it is under control, it is like the clear blue sky. Anyone who's ever seen a documentary about the Dust Bowl, this is just hellish years in the late 1920s, I think, when due to misguided farming practices, the soil in the Midwestern, some of the plains states, was loosened from its roots and it was transported up into the high into the air and became huge, dark, massive thunderheads of dust. Absolutely fascinating, in a kind of a very grim way, fascinating period in American history. And they do have some photographs, some still photographs that show coming, I think, from the west, from the Colorado, from the Rockies, and this wind bearing all of this massive dark clouds of dust. You can see it rolling in, and the poor denizens of Kansas and Oklahoma and eastern northern Texas would have nowhere to run. It would just completely engulf them in this fine dust. They tried sealing up their houses, and yet the dust would find its way in. They'd have to wipe down their dinnerware every day because it was covered with this fine silt. These became such a huge meteorological event over years and years that, it wasn't until these huge clouds of dust reached Washington, D.C. and found their way into the Capitol, onto the papers of our good servants there, that they realized something had to be done about it. All of this, I think, is not a bad simile for the operation of the mind as it brings in thoughts. And half of this work that we're doing is to notice it. Notice when the thoughts are rolling in. Noticing the thoughts as thoughts. It's only then, when we identify them as thoughts, that we have this choice opens up to us as to where we direct our attention. And of course, we want to direct it to that which is beyond thought. Mu. What? The question, what is it? What am I? Who am I? The breath. Yes, the breath is beyond thought. When we are purely absorbed in the breath, we are absorbed in experience, direct experience, not thought. It's experience. The more we practice, the more longer we practice, the more we come to appreciate how much our lives are diminished by our dwelling in thoughts, and how much they, conversely, how much they are enriched when we can remain free of thought. When we don't need to be thinking, that means, of course, there are times when we need to think. We need to solve problems and plan, but when we don't need to be just dwelling in this cloud in the mind, is so much a way of just suffering. He continues, as long as students of the way haven't seen through their conscious minds, all their activities and words are the deeds of karmic consciousness. They are not in accord with the way. Whether they are bright or dull, knowledgeable or ignorant, thoughtful or thoughtless, with or without desires, whether they use expedient means or study the direct teachings, whether they are venerated or held in contempt, whether they perform miracles and have feelings of love and pity, these are, after all, activities of the conscious mind. This is very different from teaching of trying to cultivate positive thoughts. There are various teachings that offer this as a way to change your life, and sure it does. It can, when used well. But it's all in the realm of, what we call the six realms of unenlightened existence. So that, yes, perhaps by nourishing positive thoughts, cultivating the ability to be positive, happy, or loving, yes, this might reward us with an existence in what we call the realm of heavenly beings, or devas. These are the highest of the six realms of unenlightened existence. But it's a conditioned state. That means it's subject to change, changing conditions. We're never going to be secure just by cultivating, finding a way to manipulate our minds to have positive thoughts all the time. Because the conditions under which we're able to do that will not last. They certainly will be stripped of those skills on our deathbed, or as we're moving on into the bardo. The only security is seeing through all of the work of this discriminating mind, positive or negative, to see the limits of it. I often refer to Yasutani Roshi holding up a ballpoint pen and saying, if this pen represents our true mind, our original nature, then this, what the translator here is calling our conscious mind, or the discursive mind, the intellect, is no more than the tip of the pen, the ball at the end of that pen. He continues, when it is cold, all heaven and earth are cold. When it is hot, all heaven and earth are hot. When there is justice, everything is just. When there is evil, everything is evil. When you stop the movement of the conscious mind and realize the way of no mind, whether you practice rightly or wrongly, speak or remain silent, are active or quiet, the I is never there. All is the turning of the right Dharma wheel. This reference, when it's hot, everything's hot, when cold, everything's cold, and so forth, reminds us that ultimately everything is mind. that our perceptions are determined by the mind. Our experience is determined by the mind. This is the very premise of meditation, that by changing the mind, by learning to work with the mind and skillfully, and to be able to direct our attention, we change our experience. We change our reality. It's got to be some huge evolutionary shift represented by undertaking meditation practice. Not just Zen, but understanding, recognizing the vital, the primary importance of working with the mind, learning how to work with the mind as a way of changing our life, changing our relationships, changing our experience at work, changing our way of raising our children, changing everything. It starts with the mind. He goes on, from the outset, there has never been evil and good with regard to the Dharma. Evil and good simply exist when you are trying to destroy the conscious mind and you still haven't done so. That is, getting caught in dualistic concepts of right and wrong or good and evil. If you clearly eliminate the drunken mind, drunken rages will instantly stop and mind and body will be calm and quiet. If you want to recover completely from your illness, then stay free when sitting, lying down, and when doing walking meditation, and don't rely on another's power. The illness here would mean, of course, the sickness of seeing things in a bifurcated way of seeing the illness of self and other, us and them. You see how this works. Yeah, you probably do. Everyone who's here would understand this basically, but I'll just finish. We start with this ego delusion. You know, what Hakuin says, the cause of our sorrow is ego delusion. And what that means is this rooted delusion of a self apart from other than self. And from that root then comes the division into us and them. From self and other comes us and them, where we, through identifying with a group, a race or an ethnic group or a religion, whatever our tribal affiliation is, through identifying with that, then we set up the other, them. I'm so pleased to see that the word otherism has found its way into contemporary discourse. It's a good word. And then from that whole division into us and them, spawned all kinds of conflicts, racial, ethnic, religious conflicts, war. It all starts with this discriminating mind, this mind that separates in its own delusive way. It creates this illusion of separation. He says, just stop your wandering. Look penetratingly into your inherent nature. And concentrating your spiritual energy, sit in Zazen and break through to the self. then you will, for the first time, attain liberation. The breakthrough to the self, it's a small s, self here. I think it would be more understandable if it were a capital S self. Breakthrough the small s self into this original self, our essential self. If you simply try to stop the movement of consciousness and consider this enlightenment, it will be like searching for a fish, considering it a jewel, or searching after a robber and treating him as your child. This will put an iron wall between you and enlightenment. It will be a hateful traitor, damaging the Dharma treasure. That's why it is said that you must look at the self like one with fresh hatred viewing an enemy. Only then will you succeed. Now, this doesn't mean to turn with hatred toward what we see of ourself. The big mistake is objectifying the self, thinking that we can see the self. The self that we see as ourself is ourself. That's the mistake. Anyone who thinks he sees herself or himself clearly should ask, all right then, if that's you, that picture you have of yourself, that image, those thoughts, then who's seeing that one? It's a good question to ask when we get all tangled up in self-criticism, judging ourselves, is to just stop. Okay, all right. Who's seeing that one? Don't leave that one out. That one is beyond good and bad, enlightened or deluded. I believe when he says, look at the self like one with fresh hatred viewing an enemy, he means, as I was saying yesterday, with this fierce attention, this unwavering attention and determination to penetrate what appears before us as the self. The worst thing we can do is make an enemy out of this ego self. It's a terrible mistake because there's nothing there. It's an illusion. Questioner, today I realize for the first time that all these years I have been searching after a robber and treating him as my child. His frequent references to robbers or bandits, I think, speaks to what a huge menace they were in the Middle Ages in China as well as Japan. Just by the references you run across in these old texts, must have been seen as really a great threat. These are cultures where, at the time, the rule of law was tenuous at best, or without any rule of law. Once you got out of the capital, out of the cities, and to venture out, it would be to expose yourself to great loss. There were no banks in ancient China or Japan where you could secure your money. To travel meant to carry your valuables with you, and then you were vulnerable. He's reminding us that that what we think of as the self is not our true self. I have been searching after a robber and treating him as my child. Though I may see my mistake, if I do not actually destroy this conscious mind myself, the moment of liberation will never arrive. So with what expedient means will I rid myself of it? And Basui, there is no particular expedient means. If you just detach from all forms in your mind, of course that means thoughts, all forms in your mind, and don't fall into the pit of formlessness, that is, getting into a state of emptiness, liberation will manifest in your body as it is right now. Just again, about the pit of formlessness, it's becoming attached. That means becoming attached to formlessness. And there is a state that we can sometimes slip into, especially in Sesshin, where we imagine that a temporary absence of thought is some kind of final arrival place. Yes, form is only emptiness, but also emptiness is only form. Always we have to be on the alert for the mind. Yeah, this devil, the conscious mind, appropriating for its own purposes what it pictures as the true emptiness that is form. And then he quotes Zen Master Mumon, who edited the Mumonkan, or the author, I guess, of the collection of koans called the Mumonkan. And here is Zen at its most radical, the most confounding. This is what Zen Master Mumon said: to obey the regulations and keep the rules is to tie yourself without a rope. Arbitrary selfishness is heresy and devilry. Becoming settled and quiet while the mind exists is the heretical Zen of silent illumination. Doing as you will, neglecting relationships, you fall into the deep pit of liberation. To be clever and clear-headed is to be tied in chains, to be bound in shackles. Let me just stop and comment on a couple of these, because it goes on. To obey the regulations, to keep the rules, to tie yourself without a rope, that is to be attached to rules and regulations, seeing them as some final truth rather than a means to an end. Becoming settled and quiet while the mind exists is the heretical Zen of silent illumination, that is, sitting with thoughts having settled, the mind has become somewhat quiet, and thinking that that's it, when that too is just a conditioned state. It'll pass. This is what always worries me so much about the second half of Sesshin, is people can so easily settle into a quiet state, which can be so seductive. Ah, how wonderful this deep stillness. But until we see into the mind, see through this discriminating mind and awaken to our true nature, we're vulnerable in that state. How many people have settled into this deep quiet and then 3 days after Sesshin find themselves with all their karmic noise in the mind stirred up again? Sesshin is an opportunity to overturn the world. We can't treat it as a kind of mental vacation, or we can, but then we're really settling for far less than it could be. Doing as you will, neglecting relationships, you fall into the deep pit of liberation. I think he's probably talking about a certain kind of squirrely state that the monks would get into, where they saw nothing as mattering. Everything is the same. And they would act with kind of crazy, kind of a pose of being liberated. To be clever and clear-headed is to be tied in chains, to be bound in shackles. Well, we heard yesterday, the day before, him talking about the dangers of cleverness, the dangers of wittiness. And then he continues, to think of good and bad is to dwell in the temples of heaven and hell. Fixed views of the Buddha and Dharma enclose you in the two iron mountains. Let's see here. According to Buddhist mythology, there are nine mountain ranges around Mount Sumeru, the center of the universe. The outermost range, the two iron mountains, symbolizes the borders of the universe. I remember at a conference with the Dalai Lama, heard him say that he doesn't believe there's a Mount Sumeru. He said it as though this would shock his Tibetan brethren. Maybe it did, some of them. Dalai Lama, according to accounts, is a man of science. He respects science and research. And he had the good sense to see that this Mount Sumeru is just a metaphor, but that is not to be taken for granted in Tibet or any of the uneducated people in these cultures. I think he even said, I know that what I'm saying is provocative and I'll be criticized by some, but I don't believe there's a Mount Sumeru in the center of the universe, surrounded by mountains. Okay. Maybe I'm wrong, but let's see. He goes on, one who has an instant awakening from an arising thought is sporting with spirits. He must mean some kind of a psychological or philosophical insight, thinking it's awakening. Meditation in complete stillness is an activity of the devil. When you advance, you are deluded by Buddhist principles. When you retreat, you act contrary to Buddhist principles. When you can neither advance nor retreat, you are a breathing corpse. Now, how on earth can you practice this after all? You see what the Zen Master Mumon is doing is just taking a rocket-propelled grenade to all of our notions about the way things are, the way things should be, our notions of silence and stillness and calmness and Dharma, these words, these Buddhist words, Buddhist doctrine, and trying to unshackle us from our tendency to take these things as real. When in fact they're just the fingers pointing to the moon. He wants us to experience the moon and not get caught in the words and phrases that can be so seductive. And finally, if you practice and realize this now in this way, you will comprehend the great matter of life and death. If, however, you become obstructed by the theory and do not penetrate the gate of the patriarchs, you will sink in the sea of delusion through eternity. This is why the ancients, arousing their fearless aspiration, spent 20, 30, 40 years, even their whole lives, refraining from lying down, forgetting to sleep or eat, practicing single-mindedly, applying spiritual energy in response to the occasion, looking penetratingly into their own nature, and hence realizing the light of their own spiritual essence. All karmic hindrances are founded in this conscious mind, and this so-called conscious mind is founded in Buddha nature. So even this discriminating mind, this discursive mind, is itself not outside our true nature. Again, not to make an enemy of this idea of this certain this mind that functions in a certain way in terms of dividing. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot karma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot karma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain. Thank you.